A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 328. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and this time we are continuing our discussion about Penda's Fen. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
We are talking about this well-regarded television film from BBC's Play for Today series. It's a 90-minute color production from 1974. And this is our October Halloween type show. So this is getting into the folk horror genre that we like to talk about sometimes. It is a complex and somewhat opaque show with lots of different ideas. It has a mixture of British sort of myth or legend and political turmoil and a young man's awakening and how he is relating to all of these things, along with some weird imagery and music by Edward Elgar.
It's quite a heady mix, really, Brian, isn't it? And it can, as you say, be a little bit challenging and difficult to know what's going on with this show. But we'll get into that in a moment, I guess.
Absolutely.
So we've mentioned our protagonist, Stephen, played by Spencer Banks, a young man who's got a lot on his plate, basically. He is being bullied at school. He is having doubts about his religious faith, which is tricky when your father's the vicar. He's got change in political views, looking at what's happening in the world around him. And of course, he's got his own awakening sexuality and his attraction to a number of the bullies, both in and out of the school, who you wouldn't think he would be having dreams about, but he does. And as well as that, he's having these strange visions that you've mentioned, in which he will see an angel. He will see a demon, the sort of figure that, or the masked figure that appears on the front cover of the DVD and Blu-ray. And of course, he'll see Sir Edward Elgar himself when he memorably gets to have a conversation with him about the dream of Gerontius and other Edward Elgar bits of music.
Yes, absolutely. There is a lot going on in here. And there is this idea of a sort of turbulent coming of age for Stephen. And all of these other things in the outside world are interacting with that as well. And we have some strange and inexplicable things happening with these visions. But also out in the world, there are some strange and unusual things that we see happening that are not in his head.
Yes, there's the political meeting we mentioned last time with the television playwright who's espousing his own political views. We've got Stephen going on long walks with his father to talk about religion and faith and having these sort of ethical, moral and sort of almost metaphysical discussions. Then we get Stephen sort of being a witness to some very strange ritualistic behaviour by sort of upper class groups, which I guess, again, must be visions because it gets very Wicker Man for a moment there, Brian, I think.
It does. And we also get people who wander into what we know is Penda's Fen, this area that's associated with this ancient 7th century pagan king, Penda. We see people who have walked out in there being sort of burned and injured and sort of strange things happening there.
Absolutely. And of course, there's also strange sort of visions and rituals going on at Stephen's school, which has got a sort of, it's a boys' school. It's got a sort of military cadet corps. And there's some strange bits and pieces going on. Some of it seems to be real life stuff. And again, some of it seems to be Stephen imagining things happening. And I should also say that he's wrestling with the fact that we sort of learn during this play that Stephen is in fact adopted. And so some of his visions are of a couple who he believes to be his real parents. So there is an awful lot happening in this 90-minute TV film.
Yes, he is told the agreement was he had to be 18 before he would be told. He's told that he's adopted. And at the same time, he is discovering some of these different things. And he also realizes at about the same time that he's gay. And this is pretty unusual in a 1974 production to be discussing that. But it very much is part of this show.
Indeed, yes. It's a very important part of the show, an important part of Stephen's life.
We also get connections to, as we mentioned, King Penda and to pre-Christian England and sort of these things in the distant past and in the early days of Christianity, these religious elements and sort of pagan elements are important in part because of what's happening and in part because of Stephen's internal struggles.
Yes, and we, as you say, we do see these appearances by some historical figures who pop up and appear to Stephen or even interact with him.
Yes, we see King Penda appear, and we even see Edward Elgar, the composer, appear. And Elgar actually gives Stephen extra insight into his music, which is something that Stephen was studying and interpreting.
Yes, I mean, there is a particularly important piece of music that's sort of central to this show, isn't there, Ryan?
Yes, The Dream of Gerontius was written by Edward Elgar in 1900. It's for solo voices and choir and orchestra. It features quite prominently in the soundtrack of this production, of course, but is also something that at the beginning of the play, Stephen is reading about it, and you actually see the score for it on screen, and he is interpreting some of what is in the music and the text. The text is actually a poem by John Henry Newman, and it deals with a man who has died facing judgment in the afterlife and then settling into purgatory. It's a very Christian thing, which fits very much into the type of thing that people were composing in England quite often in 1900, and it fits very much into this television production, Penda's Fan, and the struggles that Stephen has with religion and with other things, and how he looks at this and feels he understands it very well at the beginning and then learns more about it later, both through insight from Elgar himself, but also through his own development and thinking about things.
Interesting stuff. And, you know, and how nice for us to have a piece of sort of very influential classical choral music for you to talk about here, Brian, one of your many areas of expertise.
Well, it certainly is nice to have a little bit like that to talk about. I don't know about expertise, but I have enjoyed and dealt with classical and choral music from time to time, for sure.
So let's talk a little bit about the folk horror aspects, and let's link it to our other TV shows. I know, I think listeners will be familiar with the film folk horror Unholy Trinity, as they're known, which is Witchfinder General, Blood on Satan's Claw, and of course, the sort of text for folk horror, The Wicker Man. Now, without really intending to, we've sort of come across and now covered the sort of the trinity of 1970s plays for today, which have a loose sort of folk horror theme and are often mentioned in the sort of same breath by people covering folk horror on television and film. So we did Robin Redbreast from 1970, and that was on our episodes 311 and 312. We've also covered a while back Red Shift, based on the Alan Garner book. That was released in 1978. We covered it back on episodes 202 and 203. And now we sort of get to the middle one in this strange trilogy, Penda's Fen from 1974. And all of them, I would say, I guess we'd say, Brian, they have a sort of connection between 1970s modernity and the past. Often a conflict between the past and the present as well, which I guess is something that folk horror often tends towards.
Yes, that's right. And they do all have a reputation for being somewhat oblique or difficult. It's quite common in folk horror to deal with feelings and emotions and to deal with these sort of themes about what is real and what people feel or are going through without necessarily having concrete explanations. They tend to focus on atmosphere and ideas and sort of a sense of dread or unease. And this means they often don't have traditional storylines. Although I think The Wicker Man is slightly more traditional in its storylines than some of the others.
Yes. And it almost feels to me, Brian, as if we have to put on slightly different hats when we discuss these shows. And if our listeners haven't watched any of these three classic sort of 1970s plays, or indeed haven't seen Artemis 81, they might be wondering why we're sort of not going into details of the plot in great detail. And it's possibly because that isn't so much what's here. As you say, Brian, this is sort of stuff about feelings and emotions and a strange atmosphere of things happening or weird connections and old rituals. They're strange shows in a way, and I think we do have to look at them in a slightly different frame of mind.
Yes. They definitely tend to be character over story, but they also tend to deal with these ideas and the sort of strangeness of it in a very significant way. So they do have quite a different feel than a lot of more conventional drama.
Yes. And now we also mentioned, we've mentioned it a couple of times, this show Artemis 81 by the same writer, David Rudkin. I mean, I would guess, Brian, his adaptation of M.R. James's The Ash Tree is slightly more conventional and sort of sticks with the James text, I think, fairly closely. But Artemis 81, that strange show where Sting appears as a sort of fallen angel interacting with a character on, you know, who's going through some weird stuff, and there was bits about a Hitchcockian blonde in there and an evil angel. It was a very strange show that did indeed, I think, build more on atmosphere than actually explaining what was going on. And it's similar stuff here, I guess, in Pender's Fen.
Yes, and I think the way that it uses music is related. There are some similarities there. In both cases, you had someone who was playing a work of music and discussing it. You see the score on screen. And in one case, it was more about the interpretation of it. In the other case, it was more about playing it and that type of performing interpretation of it. But in both cases, there is a central character who was a musician who was sort of delving into a work.
Ah, interesting comparison. As you say, music is certainly a big part of this show and of Stephen's life and his sort of fascination with the Dream of Gerontius and Sir Edward Elgar. And as you say, we even see, I think, the sleeve notes and the, from the 1970 recording conducted by Benjamin Britten. So, as you say, big part of this show is the music.
Yes, and we see the actual score, the actual sheet music for it. And we briefly have Stephen playing organ. One of the main characters in Artemis 81 was playing a work on the organ.
Oh, that's right. Yes, there are connections there as well, aren't there?
So you have those things, and you have some of these sort of thematic ideas, although I feel that Artemis 81 was a little more in a more modern kind of category than the folk horror things, because it was dealing with the film references and with a lot of quite modern things, as well as these sorts of issues that do feel a little bit more folk horror-like, but it was doing it in a more modern way and incorporating some other things as well.
Okay, very interesting stuff. And it's time for us to get into some more detail about our own feelings about this show, Pender's Fen. A show that we put on our list for this year, Brian, but that, you know, knowing of its reputation, but not knowing too much more about it, and which we've both watched, I guess, in a fairly sort of cold, straight into it way in the last week or so. So what did you think? What did you like about Pender's Fen by Alan Clarke and David Rudkin?
Well, it's interesting. This is one that I have enjoyed the thinking about it and discussing it afterwards more than my initially watching it. And I think this is one that has a lot of value in rewatching, as I think a lot of the folk horror stuff does, because it's so dense in its ideas. So to start with, I have to say I liked how they incorporated so many ideas into this and how they tied his coming of age types of things into these sort of rich ideas and into the things happening around him.
Yes, it's certainly a show with an awful lot of ideas in it. There is, as we've said many a time, quite a lot going on in this show. And, you know, the development of Stephen as a character, as he's wrestling with all these difficult things, is very interesting, particularly to talk about it afterwards, I think. It also looks great, I think. It's a nice transfer, remastered onto the DVD and Blu-ray. I've been watching the Blu-ray and it looks sort of very, very nice. The great landscapes, of course. We're going to see lots of England and particularly the Fen itself. So that all looks great, particularly if you've got Elgar's music playing over it, Brian.
Yes, it is a very sort of, artistically beautiful piece as a visual work and a visual and sound work.
And of course, we've got, you know, as we've said, we've got Elgar's music, we've got that Britain recording of it. We've also got Paddy Kingsland, who's doing great stuff with electronic variations, and he's a name that we know well as well. So, I particularly enjoyed him cropping up on this show.
Yes, absolutely. Those things were all done very well. And as you say, it's lovely to have Elgar's work in here. And the way that it's used in the story is interesting, and it's well done. I was quite fascinated to see that they had the central character as a young gay man, and that it was something that was a major part of the story and the character, which is very unusual for 1974. It's not the earliest production with a gay character that we've seen on British Invaders, because The Guardians was a couple years earlier. The Guardians also dealt with that well, but it was one scene, and it was interesting. It was used well. This was much more ambitious than that, and it becomes a major part of it. So it was very nice to see that. Even before we see much about that, of one of his parents referring to him as being just in a phase and the other being more accepting. Well, this is something that, as you might imagine, ties to these ideas quite strongly. Now, there are a couple of points where there are things that are a little bit questionable related to that and some of the lines, but that, I think, mostly is about it being dated and how the writing was handled. I was quite pleased to see that those issues were there and were used reasonably well.
Yes, it is interesting. And I particularly, like yourself, I particularly like the fact that his mother, or his adopted mother, is shown as being very sort of accepting and, more honest about this than perhaps the father figure is. It's very interesting stuff and very sort of like well handled in a 1974 show. So as you say, quite unusual for television at the time.
Yeah, there's one moment where it is not handled as well, but considering the age of it, I think it's pretty good to have as much coverage and as much dealing with that as we do.
And of course, we've got the performances. We have Spencer Banks. You know, like I say, I know him from Time Slip, in which he was much younger. That's a, you know, a different type of role altogether. He's the sort of one of the pair of sort of early teen protagonists who find themselves caught up in these adventures back in time or in the future. So, but this is quite different for him and quite an interesting performance. Very sensitively done, I think. And the other performance is, you know, I wasn't particularly familiar with the rest of the cast. I can't quite remember Ian Hogg from Ghostlight, but I know you know that he shows up there, Brian. But they're interesting and sort of all pretty good all round, I think.
Yes, absolutely. Spencer Banks in Time Slip was sort of a very, very charismatic young actor, and I think the charisma of his performance carries through to this. But here we have quite a challenging role where he has a lot to do. And in many ways, he is not a very likable character. He is at some points, but he is also going through this sort of very brash teenage type of thing where he is speaking somewhat harshly with other people when he sees things that need to be corrected and so on. But very much fits with him as an 18-year-old. But it's a performance where, despite some of these unlikable aspects at some times, we still like him and we're still interested. So I liked his performance in this a lot. And I think the other performances were less challenging and less crucial to this. But they were solid, they were good, and they provided those conversations and those other people that he could bounce off of, and all of that worked well. I think they were good performances, but they were also performances that supported the lead, which was really needed in this, I think.
Yes, they do, I think. And as you say, Spencer Banks, who I think makes the character of Stephen very likable, although, as you say, Brian, at the start of the show, he's very sort of know-it-all and thinks he's fairly certain in his worldviews and political views and his religious and musical views. But as the show progresses, he finds a lot of that stuff shaken and changing. And he handles it very well, I think, as an actor, and makes it very watchable as a performance.
Yes, yeah, I think so.
We do have some startling imagery. We get appearances, as we say, of historical figures, briefly see angels. We get a strange sort of demonic figure that appears on his bed, which wears the mask that we see on the front cover of the Blu-ray and DVD set. So we get some startling stuff. It's not often, or in fact, not really explained to us, it just happens, but it certainly contributes to the look and feel of this show.
Yes, absolutely. We get these, as you say, strange things with some of his visions or things that may not be visions. Some of it may be happening in the real world and it isn't clear. And then we have the things with people being mysteriously burned and the like on the fan. And those clearly are real within those shows, that we see people being injured. And it's quite vivid. And the imagery, as you say, is quite strong.
Yes. Now, I wanted to say something about, or to, you know, to think a little bit about experimental television in the 70s, Brian. One of the points that, you know, you've made going right back to the start of British Invaders is how early television was very much like theatre. It followed theatre, and that productions were thought to be sort of ephemeral one-offs. And then many of them, you know, in the early days, of course, done live to camera like a theatre production. And then as we move into the 70s, I can see, you know, that theatre was starting to be more experimental with the form. And the Play for Today series, of course, allowed for some very interesting and challenging shows. And I think these three folk horror shows that we've sort of loosely grouped together, they have that form. They have this sort of like that they're pushing at the boundaries of television for the time. It may not always work for us with our modern viewers' eyes, but it is, I guess, you know, for the time, Brian, this was really sort of cutting edge in a way.
Yes, I think that's right. And it was meant to sort of focus on these ideas and be dense and be quite different and be challenging. And I think it succeeds on those. And I think one advantage we have now that we didn't have in the 70s is that it's relatively easy to rewatch these things. And I think a show like this has a lot of value in a second viewing and perhaps more viewings beyond that.
That is interesting, actually, as you say. Yes, the chance to rewatch. Of course, famously with Robin Redbreast, they had that, I think, power cut so that many people didn't see the last 10 minutes. So it got a fairly soon repeat on the BBC, as I remember. But yeah, for this one, it wouldn't be shown again on the BBC for something like 16 years. So nowadays, of course, we can watch it again and perhaps try and unpick some of the stuff that's going on. But it's certainly striking as a piece of television. And when you consider what was going on at the time, I think, you know, it does have an impact. I was thinking about experimental television now, and I think we nowadays, television producers and showrunners tend to sort of experiment more with story and plot devices, making anti-heroes the lead protagonists or concealing sort of twists or time shifts and things like that. But this was doing something different with television in 1974, I think, Brian.
Yes, that's right. And I think these things that we see in the 1970s and maybe very early 80s with Artemis 81, there are things that we don't see as a way that people experiment with film and TV very much. Certainly not in English language productions, maybe slightly more in some other things. But yes, this idea of focusing on the themes and the ideas and how they tie to the central character, and then the storyline being less prominent and the storyline and the other characters being there to support those ideas and the journey for that character. That's a different way of looking at things.
Yes, and I do feel that we need a slightly different way of looking at things ourselves when we approach these shows. It's not like we're covering something like Time Slip or even, say, you know, Thunderbirds or I guess even Space 1999, which is, you know, in the news at the moment because of the Big Finish audios. These folk horror shows, they're rather more sort of tricky and slippery to get hold of, and you have to approach them a certain way, I think, Brian.
Yes, I think there is a lot to say for that. It's a different way of sort of approaching drama and television as art.
Okay. I mean, of these plays for today that we've been considering, did you have a particular favorite that you would pick from them yourself?
Of these three that we mentioned, I would actually choose Redshift, and that's mainly because it has the three different time periods with the connections between them and brings something different through that.
Okay, that's interesting. At the moment, I'm sort of torn between Pender's Fen and Robin Redbreast, and I think I'm slightly edging towards Robin Redbreast, but they're all three interesting shows to think about and to perhaps rewatch and talk about.
Very much so. And I am feeling that I particularly want to come back to Pender's Fen and watch it again because it has such interesting visuals and such interesting ideas, and it is so dense, and I think it takes at least another viewing to get a stronger sense of what it's about, and there's more to get from that.
There is quite a lot to get from this show, yes, very good.
So I think it's time for our recommendations. Eamon, would you like to start with a recommendation for this?
Okay, so I would say this is one to approach, like we discussed, if you have a sort of folk horror interest, this is going to be the sort of show that you're going to like to see. It's very interesting experimental television from 1974. It's got some great names attached to it. It is a challenging watch because, you know, things are not clear cut. There are no easy answers. But I'm going to say, you know, from this BFI release on DVD and Blu-ray, it's not terribly expensive. So I'm going to give this a cautious recommendation. And I would certainly say check it out as a trilogy with Robin Redbreast and Redshift. So I'm going to say yes, a cautious yes from me, Brian. What about yourself?
Okay, this is definitely a tricky one to figure out where to go on this. When I watched it immediately after, I was thinking this is not going to be a recommendation for me. It's just too strange and too non-plot focused. But the more I think about it and the more we discuss it, the more I appreciate what they were doing. And it does have beautiful visuals and some lovely things with the music. And its work with the ideas is very good indeed. And seeing this very early examination of a gay character through a coming-of-age story, also very interesting stuff. So one thing I have to recommend is know what you're getting into with this and with the other folk horror Play for Today productions. They are strange and they do take some effort to get into them, and maybe multiple viewings, which is nice to be able to get something from multiple viewings if you're buying something. So this is certainly not for everyone. It is strange and it's complicated. It is opaque in some ways, but there is a lot of interesting stuff and there's a lot to enjoy there. So it's a cautious recommendation for me as well. If you want to explore something complicated and layered that is not focused on the plot, then some of these folk horror things would be a very interesting choice. And Penda's Fan, I think for sure, would be a good one to include with that. So it's a cautious recommendation from me as well.
Excellent stuff. And of course, if you've got your own particular favorites, if you like this sort of stuff, or if you've got other shows to recommend to us with a sort of folk horror-y theme, then please get in touch on the Gmail or on the Facebook group.
Yes, absolutely. We've talked about these three folk horror productions on British Invaders. And we've also mentioned those three movies that are considered important in folk horror. We also covered the serial called The Owl Service that fits into that. I would be very interested to hear your thoughts on any of those, or folk horror as a whole, or any other suggestions for folk horror. It's an interesting genre of its own, and there are some interesting things there.
Fascinating stuff.
So, in summary, Penda's Fan introduces us to young Stephen Franklin, who is about to turn 18 and is dealing with all sorts of issues of growing up, and he is about to have new things revealed about himself, including finding out that he was adopted, and he is investigating things about religion and his beliefs and about the music of Elgar and the religious meanings that are there and about things that go back into ancient history. And he is, along with this, experiencing some strange visions that relate to some of these ideas and themes. And there are, in fact, some strange things happening in the real world that tie to his own experiences and these visions. Things related to politics and even strange things with people being injured and burned going into this strange area, a geographic figure sometimes called a fan, in this village of Pinvin, which ties back to, as we discover, the ancient King Penda, and what is known as Penda's Fan.
Well done, Brian. As ever, always challenging to summarize these slightly obscure folk horror shows, but neatly done.
Well, there's some interesting stuff there, but yes, finding points of summary is a little bit tricky on that.
And come back and join us next time. Perhaps we're on slightly safer ground with a big show from the BBC, the sequel to Life on Mars, Ashes to Ashes, that ran from 2008 to 2010. And we've got more police procedural stuff going on in the early 1980s this time, with cars and cops and robbers and all that stuff.
Yes, and some interesting sort of sci-fi elements fitting in there. And we get Keeley Hawes in the lead, and it's always lovely to see her.
Yes, indeed.
Until then, you can find all of our British Invaders episodes, including the folk horror ones we've mentioned, at BritishInvaders.com. You can find us there. Or you can search for British Invaders on Facebook and find our Facebook group, where we have some fun conversations there. And I'm sure we will be talking about lots of things related to folk horror.
Yes, do drop in on the Facebook group, or head to the Voice of Geeks Network. That's at vognetwork.com, where you'll find British Invaders is a proud member of one of a series of shows they have there on vognetwork.com, the Voice of Geeks.
Yes, indeed. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada signing off.
Yes, thank you very much indeed. Until next time, Eamon in England also signing off. We'll be right back.